All right, primary elections. I'm recording this program bright and early on Wednesday morning because we have a deadline that actually was yesterday, but we can squeak that a little bit here. And wanted to just tell you a little bit about what went on in the elections this week. You probably already know, but there were, you know, three U.S. Senate seats up, primaries that is, and 46 U.S. House seats. So, of course, the highest profile race, the Democratic Senate primary in Michigan, where at this moment, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, he's a public health officer and used to work with the Obama administration, versus U.S. Congresswoman Haley Stevens. They've been in a tight race, very tight, because as of this morning, it's still too close to call officially, although, come on, I mean, with over 1.5 million votes cast, El-Sayed has got a 1 percentage point lead with 96% of the vote counted. So that's pretty much a win. It's a big deal. I mean, it shows that the more Democratic voters are tired of the status quo. And yeah, status quo, because Stevens was endorsed by, you know, all the big name Democrats, Governor Whitmer, Chuck Schumer, or as I like to call, you know, the U.S. Senate leaders, Democratic leaders' endorsement, the kiss of death. Chuck Schumer backing Stevens, his track record here in Iowa is absolutely terrible, and I presume it's not much better around the country, but the Big D's got beat by a guy who was endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America and Bernie Sanders, although he says he's not a socialist, he just believes that capitalism has to be regulated. Yeah, all right, fair enough. Also in Michigan, another very interesting race, a fellow named William Lawrence. He's the co-founder of the Sunrise Movement. That's the youth-led climate movement that has made a lot of noise until recently. I haven't heard much of them in the last few years. Maybe I'm just missing out on that, but they certainly garnered a lot of attention around the Green New Deal. He won the Democratic primary in Michigan's 7th congressional district. I believe that's a swing district. I'm not quite sure. But he beat two prominent Democrats. Maybe they divided the vote. We'll see how that shapes up in the fall. So another big race in Missouri. Representative Cori Bush lost her rematch. She had been beaten by Wesley Bell a couple of years ago. And a lot of her platform has been opposition to Israel's genocide in Gaza. AIPAC, the American-Israeli, it's not Political Action Committee, but basically the PAC that the Israeli government and its Zionist supporters fund put a lot of money into beating her last time. But AIPAC this year has been losing races left and right. I've shared my own AIPAC story with you before. Not pretty. And between AIPAC, Bell's own contributions to his campaign and other outside groups, I'm assuming that the U.S. House leadership, the Democratic leadership in the U.S. House, also supported Bell. Well, they outspent Cori Bush 27-1. I mean, that's like getting run over by a herd of bulldozers. I mean, it's hard to see any candidate having a chance against those kind of numbers. Anyway, she did lose. Kudos for taking another shot at it, because again, I think a lot of this had to do with that big money coming in. So I always respect and admire candidates, wherever they are on the political spectrum, who try to run low-budget campaigns. Okay, in Washington State, there was Maria Glusenkamp Perez. She's a maverick of sorts, for sure. She does not fit in well with many within the Democratic Party. But she's done well. She's won in the Republican district. I think it might even be the most Republican House district in the U.S. So she doesn't really fall into the two camps that the mainstream media like to talk about. And she won her primary. It was a very narrow victory. And it's one of those primaries, like we also have seen in California, where it's an open primary. The top two vote getters, regardless of party affiliation, move on to the general election. So she and the lead Republican finished within, like, I think a percentage point or two. they will face off in the general. And so that's good news for her, because most of the other votes went to another Democrat. So who knows what'll happen? But anyway, she's an intriguing candidate because she focuses on things like being able to fix your own, you know, your own vehicles, your own tools. She owns an auto repair shop. She talks about I think the expression was the plague of bright headlights. I can relate to that. Headlights have definitely gotten brighter, more obnoxious, more difficult to navigate at night. And she's trying to do something about it. Good for her. She's got some other issues that all of us probably, most of us listening, would probably disagree with. But anyway, it'll be an interesting election this fall between her and her Republican opponent. But I want to take issue with the mainstream media. I mean, and NPR, CNN, The New York Times, you name it. They like to talk about, quote, moderates. Moderate Democrats, centrist Democrats. And that's always juxtaposed against progressive Democrats. And I get so tired of these labels. I mean, come on. Have we not had enough? What does moderate even mean? Moderate in what way? What does centrist mean? What are you central to? Are you between two extremes? Are you between two different visions? Are you between a corporate agenda and a populist agenda? I mean, I think Paul Wellstone, the U.S. Senator from Minnesota who died tragically in an airplane crash years ago and was in some ways my political mentor, I think Paul Wellstone nailed it when he said, yeah, I'm a centrist. I'm fighting for issues that are central to the lives of my constituents. That sums it up. But that's not what the media means by it. The media means by it, basically, it's a compliment to be called moderate or centrist by the New York Times or NPR. And if you're progressive, then you're out there a bit too far. If you're conservative, you're probably okay, but you know, maybe not quite out there as far as progressive, but you're still, you know, tagged. And I happen to think that conservative is a legitimate label when it comes to financial stuff. When you are conservative when it comes to money, you are hesitant to overspend. I was a conservative. I was, when it came to fiscal matters, I was absolutely conservative as a state lawmaker. I have a voting record to prove it. That didn't stop me from getting labeled as extreme liberal. And, you know, to me, liberal literally means generous, okay with spending to help people. I mean, to me, that's what a classic liberal is. I mean, I look at it in economic terms. Beyond that, you get all mixed up when you start considering conservatives as somebody who is against marriage equality or is against abortion rights. I think the best way to look at those kind of issues is through the lens of a libertarian. You know, do you want government involved in these decisions or not? If you get those publications, challenge their use of the words moderate and centrist, because I think what it really is code for friendly toward corporate interests. That's really what they mean by it. They don't mean what Paul Wellstone meant by centrist. They don't mean central, you know, concerned about, the centrist is concerned about the issues central to the lives of their constituents. They don't mean that at all. They mean something relevant to how friendly you are toward corporate interests. I think do away with those terms, challenge them. And, you know, and the truth is, let me take Maria Gleason-Camp-Perez. She's all over the board on stuff, you know? And most people are. You know, whether you're in politics or just paying attention, you're probably all over the board on stuff. You know, there's probably not a convenient label that fits you. I got tagged as being very, very liberal, and I think it was because I was defending things like marriage equality and abortion rights. Funny, I think every libertarian's credentials collapse on one issue, and it varies from libertarian person to one to another. For me, it was gambling. I hated gambling. I hated to see an industry continue to expand, putting other small businesses out of business and basically preying on, in a lot of cases, senior citizens. So the only exception I made is I was happy to see that the Native American tribes in my state were capitalizing on gambling and finding a way to build a financial base that had been denied to them for a long time. Anyway, so my bottom line is there these tags don't work real well. You know, again, I was called very liberal as a state lawmaker. My voting record on fiscal matters, very conservative. Conservative, again, literally meaning I was hesitant to spend a lot of money. I voted against most budget bills. Sometimes I voted against them because of content. Oftentimes I voted against them because of the amount of money being spent or the oversight being provided. So we got to do away with these labels. They are really ridiculous, and they need to be challenged. Okay, especially moderate. What does moderate mean? What does it mean? Moderation in all things. Or was it Ben Franklin to coin that expression? As he really should have said, moderation in nearly all things, right? I want to move on to a couple other things before we wrap up this program. Head Start. Okay, Trump is trying to basically gut Head Start by radically changing the criteria for the program. It's been around since the 1960s. For those who don't know, Head Start is an early education program for poor kids. Families earning less than $33,000 a year, families of four, that is. The program has been struggling. The funding has often been, you know, had a hard time keeping pace with inflation and increased costs. And it's led some Head Start centers have had to trim back on services, you know, trim back on the number of people that can serve. The bottom line is Head Start has been praised by experts and parents alike. And I'm one of those parents. You know, my kids went to Head Start. We were, and back then, when in the 1980s, I think the income threshold was less than $20,000 a year. Anyway, so it was a great program. And my daughter ended up going, it's supposed to be a one-year program, but if you're caught in a certain age range, you sometimes get in for 2 years, and my daughter did. And my son went for a year. It was a great experience. They got all kinds of help. And it freed us up to accomplish our low-paid work, working goals, musician and activist. but we were doing good work, and we spent most of the time was with our kids. But during the day, for some hours, they'd go to Head Start, and it was a great experience. Great experience. I can't say enough about it, and I really hope that people are pushing back against the efforts to basically downgrade it to make it more difficult for people to be able to enroll their kids. So the one other thing I want to talk about before we wrap up this program is climate migration. There are places around the country that are already experiencing refugees from climate disasters. We certainly know about what happened in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. And like most parts of the country, Des Moines has seen people move here from New Orleans after that disaster. But some are estimating that by the end of the century, as many as 13 million Americans could have moved inland from coastal areas because of sea level rise. Now, that's been some quality research, but I'm going to go out on a limb, and I've said this before. Iowa's population is a little over 3 million. I can envision our population rising to 30 million. I mean, that's huge, but when you've got places with good soil, adequate rainfall, you know, no chance of wildfires devastating our landscape, no chance we have plenty of flood risks along the rivers, but it's not the same as sea level rise. I think we've talked about before, concerns that the Colorado River is drying up, that Lake Mead is never going to be able to meet the water needs of the Southwest, and conversations about trying to divert the Great Lakes to the Southwest, which are insane. That is an insane proposal. Iowa is not a Great Lakes state. We're one state removed, but every Great Lakes state, I think all eight of them are adamantly opposed to that. We've got to take this seriously, folks. We have to begin to think about where and how people are going to move, and how we're going to accommodate that.